I get to introduce our speaker. I don't need glasses for that. Gosh, 6 years ago? About 6 years ago, I met this young lady. I am usually at the women's meeting on Saturday mornings, and I think that's the first time I saw her was at the women's meeting that morning, and she'd asked me to be her sponsor. And truth be told, I was not looking to be a sponsor at that time, but you know, I made the mistake of asking God to help me be of maximum service to others, and Josie came knocking on my door. So, best decision God ever did for me, one of the best decisions God ever did for me, was put Josie in my life. And she's got an amazing story. I've watched her walk through a lot of various different things. I got to see her over about a few months ago accomplish a dream that she had since childhood. And it was amazing to watch what recovery does for us. And I will stop talking, let Josie tell her story. And I just adore her and love her. And I give you Josie.
Okay, now that I'm all teared up. I'm Josie, and I'm an addict and alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 29th, 2012. And I did come through Ridgeview as an inpatient, and that was the best thing I ever did, although at the time I thought it was giving up in a bad way. But anyway, I'll give you a little background just so you kind of get where I'm coming from. I was born in Buffalo, New York, so you think it's cold here. You don't know nothing. I'm the oldest of four girls in my family. Wonderful parents who are still married, happily. And, you know, I had a good thing going, you know. And although I was always... I always separated myself from my sisters. We're all very close in age, but I always referred to them as the girls. And, you know, started school, no problem. Got into, you know, I started ice skating when I was three. And life was good. Until I was about 6 or 7 years old. And my dad, was getting transferred to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I wasn't happy from the get-go about that because, you know, as an alcoholic in training, I hate change, you know? And I remember that vividly when we moved and, you know, had to go to a new school with people I didn't know and, you know, ended up quitting ice skating because they did it differently in Pittsburgh, and I didn't like that. So I just really never got over that. And like I said, I mean, my parents were very supportive, although I always saw them as people that had it all together. You know, they knew everything. I still go to my parents for things. But I didn't know until into recovery and started having honest conversations with them that, you know, they were a team, you know, and they did, you know, figure things out together. You know, I just saw the end result of that. I was good in school, I guess, because I couldn't socialize with other people. Just everything I did was based off fear, you know, and which I'm sure some of you can relate to. And so, you know, I was very good at school because I got recognition for that. And if I did good in school, then, you know, I received praise and, you know, and likewise, if I didn't, you know, I was always told, you know, that it's not that you have to be perfect, but we know what you're capable of. And for someone like me, I took that as, you know, you weren't good enough. And you're, because I was all or nothing, you know, if I'm not good at one thing, I'm just a failure altogether. So I didn't know that balance. And I'm not blaming my parents, because my sisters grew up just fine. I mean, they have their isms, but we won't get into that. This is my story. Anyway, I am the only alcoholic in my family that I'm aware of. You know, parents weren't, grandparents weren't. I mean, I'll get more into that. But at any rate, I grew up with this feeling that I had to be perfect. You know, hearing things like, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And, you know, if I'm crying, well, don't stop crying, or I'll give you something to cry about. You know, just very strict, you know? And like I said, some people would take it in stride. I didn't. What I learned was, you know, you're supposed to let everyone know you're fine. You're not supposed to ever have upset or sad feelings. You're supposed to be able to handle things on your own. I mean, not as a child, but later in life. And so that's what I showed everybody. And so at any rate, you know, continued to do well in school, was called the teacher's pet by a lot of my peers, which wasn't cool, but then again, I wasn't cool. So when I was going into high school, I decided I wanted to try public school. I had gone to a Catholic school my whole life, a small Catholic school. And for high school, I wanted to go to a public school so I could wear whatever I wanted to school. That was rational, right? And so I went from a graduating class of 26 in eighth grade to a ninth grade class of 425. And needless to say, that change really messed with me. I didn't know who I was, who I wanted to be. My grades started to go downhill. I just, again, it was just change that just rocked my world. And I would talk to anybody who would talk to me. And so because of that, I fell into the wrong crowd. You know, that's when I started smoking, because everyone was smoking. And, you know, I had the big hair and the heavy metal t-shirt. And I was a victim of my time. But anyway, so that was a mess. And that's when I started lying. Because remember, you know, I had to put on this air that everything was fine. I just needed to settle in, get adjusted. My grades would go back up, I promised. I lied about where I was going, who I was with, because I knew better. You know, my parents would just worry if I told them something, you know, that I was going to someone's house where the parents weren't home, or I was going whatever. I would be fine. It was just better they didn't know, you know, because they would worry. And they always found out. Yeah, I remember them following me a couple places. And so I was the black sheep from the get-go, and I just I just was trying to fit in, and I was terrified of, you know, talking to people. I always said what you wanted me to say, or what I thought you wanted me to say. I would, you know, sway with the wind. I would say one thing one day, and then if I talked to somebody else who had a different perspective, I would agree with them, just to make them happy. And so that was setting me up for definitely needing some solution to that. It was not with alcohol in the beginning. I was in high school, and I slept over a friend's house. We slept in the basement where there was a bar. And she gave me everything under the sun. I have no idea what I drank. She kept giving me shots, and I'm like, I'm going to throw up. And she's like, no, it just feels like that. Just keep drinking. And I'm like, no, I'm going to throw up. And I did. And I didn't drink again for a few years. That was my first experience. And I remember it because it was awful. And I was sick for days. So alcohol at first was not my friend. Well, it never was my friend. But I didn't like it. And I couldn't stomach it. And I went off to college, back into a small Catholic college where I felt more comfortable. And even drinking then, I was trying so hard. You know, I was drinking Boone's Farm and things that tasted like Kool-Aid, just awful things. And just trying to keep up with everybody. And, you know, one time my friend told me, the drinks you're ordering are too expensive. You need to learn to drink beer. Here, just hold your nose, drink the beer. And that's how I first started drinking. And I had to develop a taste for it. And that's why, looking back, it's amazing. So I tried really hard. And finally developed the taste for alcohol. But it wasn't a daily thing for me. If we weren't drinking that night, I was fine. When I drank, I never drank normally. I always kept drinking because if it made me feel good, then more would be better. And but it wasn't my life at that point. So I graduated from college with a nursing degree, and went off to work, and still overachieving, because I still didn't know how to socially, you know, intermingle with other people very well. I didn't tell you a huge part. Sorry. I'm having to do with not being able to relate to other people and finding people intimidating. Like I said, I would talk to whoever talked to me, and that went for the boys and the men that I would go out with. Weren't great guys. And one in particular I met while I was working at a nursing home in high school. And he was 9 years older than I was, but he paid attention to me, you know, and I got into a relationship with him, which of course was not condoned by my parents, and they tried to break it up. And after not too long, became, you know, emotionally abusive. He was possessive, obsessive, all of it. And at first I thought that was love, and then I realized it wasn't, but then I was stuck in this relationship and feared to get out of it, because he, you know, and this is going on through college, he threatened, you know, if I ever left him, he would kill me and then kill himself. And so I thought, well, I guess I'm just going to be in this. And, you know, I was 17, 18, 19 years old, and found myself engaged to him because he asked. I didn't want to, but I was afraid to say no. And so we were engaged for a while, and over time, and you know, making some friends in college, you know, finally realized that that's not what I want. I didn't want to live that way, and finally worked up the courage to break up with him. But of course, that did not go over well. He, you know, was stalking me, and found out later he had a shotgun in his car, and he tried to find me, but didn't, thank God. So he shot and killed himself. And that, I still don't see how it could have been resolved any other way. That I know that sounds horrible, but I feel like I would have been looking over my shoulder the rest of my life. But anyway, needless to say, that shaped a whole lot of my relationships in the future, you know. And when I finally did get into my drinking and using, you know, I was isolating, and you know, because I can't get hurt staying home alone drinking, you know. And I only bring that up not to bring up, you know, a drunkalogue or whatever. I just, because it really shaped a lot of my adult relationships until recovery, when I finally addressed it. So at any rate, I did graduate college, and other than that, college was a great experience for me. And I went to work, and was an overachiever at work, got into every project. Work was my life. Nursing was my life. You know, I got to go work in Sicily for a while. I got to work on computer projects. You know, just I got into every little project besides, you know, my regular nursing job, 'cause I could do well at that. I did well at that. Socially, still, personally, not great, you know. I always preferred to just be alone, you know. I did pick up on the drinking. I went out more, socialized, drank with people who drank like I did. You know, I worked night shift, and there was a place, Jack's, that opened 7 in the morning, and we all went there to drink after being working for 12 hours. And I don't know how I never got a DUI, because it's not like I didn't try. So, you know, in your early 20s, a lot of people, you know, are drinking, or at least the people I hung out with. So I again didn't do it daily, but when I did it, it wasn't normal. It was to excess, and it made me feel better. I could dance. I could talk to people. I could talk to men. It was pretty cool, but at that point, I didn't need it every day. I didn't need it even every weekend. So when I was 24, I emergently got sent to the hospital, and they found out I had Crohn's disease, but they had to do emergency surgery to find that out, had no idea. And while waiting, I was having excruciating pain, and like so bad, I was throwing up. I was almost climbing the walls. And then I got Demerol, and it was amazing to me. See, that's the first time, and that I remember vividly, you know. I went from climbing the walls to you know, we'll be ready soon to take you to surgery. And I'm like, oh, that's fine. Whenever you're ready, you know. Seriously. And I thought, well, this, as a nurse, you know, I never took anything other than Tylenol, you know. And to, I remember thinking, how did I not know this, you know? And so I got sent home with Percocet, and there really my story begins. That was my drug of choice, you know, much neater. I could stomach it, and that took away the pain physically, emotionally. That was my solution to what had been going on my whole life, you know? And it took away the fear. It made me, gave me energy. My house was spotless. I was running all my errands. I was so productive. Like, I don't get the people who are like, yeah, I didn't like that. It made me tired. Like, I don't know what that's like, you know? And so for a long time, that worked, but it's not, it was easier to get then than it is now, I hear, but it was, you know, after my wound had healed, what was I gonna do, you know? And so I started at work one day, you know, I had brought some pain medicine to a patient who didn't want it, legitimately just didn't want it. So I was about to throw it away. And I thought, well, what's the difference, you know, if I take it or waste it? And that's where it all started. And I felt bad, you know. I knew what I was doing was wrong, but I didn't take it from the patient because they didn't want it. And so there the rationalizing begins. And my boundaries kept getting pushed back, you know, and over, and I'm not going to tell you every incident, but over about a 5-year period, you know, it went from that to purposely taking it out, knowing they didn't want it, so then I could get it. And just violating so much trust with my colleagues because, you know, you always had to co-sign, you know, the waste. And they trusted me, you know, and I'd say, can you waste it? I already threw it away. And they would, you know. And, you know, I hurt a lot of people and put a lot of nurses' licenses on the line, and it was terrible. But I couldn't stop. I knew it was wrong, but it was still more important that I get that relief than being honest. And also, I couldn't tell anybody, because how shameful. You know, I was the worst nurse around, I thought. It was a horrible time. But I didn't think I had a problem. I thought I was just still making bad decisions. And, so 5 years into it, I got a call one evening, you know, we took you off the schedule. We need you to come in so we can talk to you, about some unusual narcotic withdrawals. And I'm like, oh really, you know? And like, well, I went in and, you know, denied it the whole time until finally, you know, I came clean. And you know, I had to write a statement about what I did that was just going to be internal, but later they gave it to the DEA. And that was just a really, although I deserved it, it was still traumatic for me. You know, I had to turn myself in, and, you know, I was in handcuffs and ankle shackles, and, it eventually got expunged. But at any rate, that was, you know, that just played into my whole, I'm not an addict, and now I'm a victim, you just don't understand me. And coming from a family with no addicts and no alcoholics, they thought that this was just really poor judgment and I need to fix this. And my attorney said, you're not a criminal, you're just in the criminal system. And like, so that all played into my denial. I'm like, you're right. And so I used that to sabotage any chance of recovery I had at that time. I was made to go to rehab. I did the outpatient thing. You saw all the differences. You weren't like me. You know, when they said, you know, you need to go to 3 AA meetings a week, I assumed that that meant for the people that didn't have support from their family or whatever. Like, I really believe that they didn't mean me. And so I can't say I relapsed because I never recovered. I was gonna fight this. I took the first step as a challenge. Powerless over alcohol, well, maybe today, but you wait. I will be the one that overcomes this myself. And so I was so resentful that, you know, I had no desire to quit. I mean, maybe for a few days, because I did learn a lot there, you know, it was good information. And but I was so, like, who are they to tell me what I can do in my own house? Because now I was going to be monitored by the State Board of Nursing for 3 years, you know, with random drug screens and reports from employers. And I can't even be anonymous. You know, everyone has to know about this. And so what I did learn in that rehab was about cross addiction. With opiates and alcohol, how it reacts similarly to in your brain, you know. And so I took that as a tip, not a warning, and said, so, okay. And after researching half-lives of medications and, you know, how long will this last, you know, when will it show up in my urine, when will it be gone, I decided that while I was being monitored, because it was so stressful, that I needed to drink. And so that's when I finally became friendly with my alcohol. And because I couldn't have my pills, because they lasted longer, they might show up on a drug screen. And they're more sophisticated now. I'm not recommending it. And Yeah, but things were not as fine-tuned as they are now. But what a job that was. So for 3 years, you know, I would, you know, log in to see if I was going to be checked, you know, for urine, and would have to drink so much water to do this, you know. And, you know, when could I keep drinking? You know, when did I have to stop drinking? On the weekends, eventually, I was taking pills too, because, you know, a couple days later, I'd be fine. Hopefully. And every time I got tested, I had an anxiety attack. Like, it was hard work, but I just, you know, at a certain point, I think I finally realized I was an addict and I was an alcoholic, but I still couldn't tell anybody, because as long as they thought I was fine, things were under control. And so, I mean, I got through 3 years and finally got some relief. And shortly after that, my sister convinced me to move to Atlanta. And so I thought, this will be great. This is perfect. Fresh start. I'll get a license down there. You know, there'll be no record of, there wasn't a record after the fact, you know. And everything will be great, you know, except that I wasn't in recovery, you know. And so I moved down here and got a job, not at the bedside, so at least I wouldn't get arrested again. That doesn't mean I wasn't taking pills, you know, from your medicine cabinet. You know, I was the first one to visit you when you had surgery or had a baby. And that always had to go to the bathroom, of course, when I was there. And, you know, I looked around, I had to get it, you know, and it's just amazing to look back at all that hard work, everything just so I wouldn't have to recover, you know, and it was my job. And it became that I was, you know, I was drinking every night, at least a bottle of wine. Towards the end, you know, pills and wine, whatever, because, you know, the little bit wasn't working anymore, so I had to do more, you know, more and more and more, until it wasn't my solution. I was irritable all the time. I was not present for family events, even if I was there. I couldn't wait till I got home. I couldn't wait to just be alone with my relationship, alcohol. That was the most important thing to me. And, you know, there was a point where I finally, you know, I accepted I am an alcoholic, but that I was also okay with that. Like, this is just the way my life is going to be. But like I said, if everyone thought I was fine, then everything was fine. So eventually, they got rid of the job that I was doing, and I had to go back to the bedside. And I picked up right where I left off. And it was bad. And it took me only 5 months, no, maybe 5 months, to be in that same situation that took me 5 years before. Because I was just careless at that point. I was just taking drugs, not accounting for anything, and so I ended up in the same situation with an intervention. You know, you must leave, you're never welcome to come back. And you know, I remember, you know, telling my parents, and just at that point I was I don't know. I can't be around it. They're like, how could you do something like this again after what happened the first time? And I'm just like, I don't know. Like, I didn't know how I could be so weak, you know? And but at any rate, you know, and again, they were like, you need to fix this, fix it. And you know, and then all that, like, well, if you were feeling this way, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you go get help? It's like, you don't get it. Like, all I cared about was my alcohol and my drugs. I had no motivation. I had no life. I was just existing, sitting on my couch, drinking every night in my safe cocoon where I couldn't get hurt. And I also just wasn't, I mean, that was it. And, I went to somewhere, I don't even remember, some psychiatrist, and who recommended Ridgeview because of the professionals program. Like, because of this, you need to go here. And so I came for an assessment, and they said, well, here's what we usually do, and you need to stay in the residence for 30 days, and then this, and then, you know, I'm like, well, but I'm I'm not withdrawing. Like, I don't need to go inpatient, like, you know, for a split second. And then I'm like, you know what? Maybe that's a good idea, you know, because when I had finally surrendered and given up, although I still thought it was a character thing, I admitted, I'm like, I don't know what to do. What I have tried doesn't work. So maybe it's a good idea that I come here and only concentrate on this, because it's clear that on my own, I can't stop, and bad things happen, and I have this life of self-loathing, you know, depression. I'm a ball of anxiety, and I just can't live this way anymore. So, all right, let's do this. And so I scheduled my admission and came in on a Monday. And I'll tell you what, now that I was willing, I saw all the similarities and not the differences. I finally read this book that people were talking, this big book that people were talking about, and realized that for the first time in my life, I fit in with people. Like, I was comfortable talking to you, and you got me. I could tell you, when I did my fifth step, instead of saying, yes, you are the most horrible person, you need to leave, they said, yeah, I've heard that before, you know? And it was amazing, you know? And then I had no problem saying, I'm an alcoholic, tell me what to do, because you get me. And honestly, it was easy, you know? And not that I didn't have to do a lot of work, but it was a whole lot less work than what I was doing, trying to beat the system. And it just was such a relief, just such a relief to not have to manage all this and hide all this and lie about this and steal. And, you know, you said I could be happy, and, you know, you said this shame would go away, and just other people could be helped by my experience, and I wanted all that, you know. And so I listened to suggestions, and like Dawn said, you know, suggestions including joining alumni and going to social events, and, you know, which, you know, I'm like, I don't know if that's for me. But then my rule of thumb at that time was, the more uncomfortable it made me, the more I should probably do it. So when I thought, no, that's not me. Like I did the first time, I didn't tell you that I told my first assessment, you know, many years ago, that I work best with individual therapy, that's how I like things to go. It's laughable now. But anyway, so, you know, I did the joining, and I did the social events, and did service work, and, you know, the service work especially, my sponsor emphasized. And gosh, when nothing else works, that'll do it, you know, to just get out of my head for a while and think about somebody else and help somebody, not so they'll like me, but just to help them. And not just because maybe they can do for me later, but just to help them, you know? And so, you know, I did that, and, you know, slowly but surely, you know, working through all the steps, I now didn't take the first step as a challenge. I took it the way I think it was meant to be taken. You know, I'm powerless. So what do I need to do? You know, clean slate. And so slowly but surely, after following the suggestions, you know, after some time, you know, I started developing some confidence, and the self-loathing kind of decreased, and I was happier, and I was living, like I was doing things, not just existing on my couch, you know? And so sobriety has given me, you know, I have to say the obsession for drugs and alcohol was lifted pretty quickly, but it was living life that I really needed help for, and or help with. And that's what this program gave me. You know, it's like, okay, so now when I'm in a stressful situation, what am I supposed to do if I can't drink? You know, that kind of a thing. And now I have tools that I can use. You know, I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor other women. That's one of the best parts of the program, you know, and that's a great feeling itself. When I'm feeling down, you know, I will call them. When I don't want to talk to anybody, I'll call them to ask them how they're doing. And for a few minutes, you know, even if it's not a crisis or anything, but for a few minutes, I can think about them, you know, and it always makes me feel better, you know. So sorry, but it really helps. And you know, I still go to 3 or 4 meetings a week, because after my 90 and 90, that's what I did, and it worked, you know. And so I still do it, because it still works, right? And I know how my thinking was before I got here. Okay, I lived 30 some years one way, you know, one way of thinking. It's not gonna change overnight, you know? And I fear that if I don't do what I did that worked, that thinking will come back. Maybe I'm not gonna go out for a drink tomorrow, but eventually, I'm a good rationalizer, I'll probably drink, you know, because the thinking starts to get sick again. So, you know, I go to meetings, and I really love meetings, and I think that we're very lucky that we have them, because there are a lot of people out there who could benefit, you know, from this program, but they don't have a place they can go almost 24 hours a day to get some therapy for free, you know? And it's like, it keeps me sane, you know? And even though today, at this moment, it's not about drinking. It's still about living life on life's terms, and that's mostly what I learn when I go to meetings and when I talk to other people in the program. I still do service work, you know, both in the program and outside the program. I'm trying to think what else. What have I meant? Huh? Oh, well, I'm gonna get that. Okay. And but at any rate, it's given me so much more than abstaining from drinking and using. You know, it's given me this great life. And last year, the day after Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law died of sudden cardiac death at 41, and left behind 2 young children. And you know, that was going to happen anyway, right? Life still happens. But I cannot imagine not being able to help my sister and the kids. And if I was still drinking, you know, I'd really want to help them. But drinking would have been my priority, you know? And I'm so glad that I'm sober for times like that, where I can, you know, I can really help and be there, even just driving the kids somewhere, you know, just whatever. I wouldn't have been able to do that. And also, what I wouldn't have been able to do is, a couple of years ago, I took my niece. She asked me out of the blue to take her ice skating in Marietta Square, and I took her before Christmas, and I got on the ice, and although not like riding a bike, it still felt like, this is great. I forgot, you know, and it had been 35 or so years since I had really skated before. But I'm like, I wonder if I could keep doing this, you know? And don't you know, I started taking lessons again, and with other adults. They do have adult classes. I wasn't, if you're picturing me with like little kids. And I got to compete in a competition in the fall, like a 40-something year old figure skater competing, like never would have imagined that, and never would have done it if I wasn't sober. I never would have followed through. I never, I would have, just amazing. I mean, I had to face fear. I had to face my perfectionism, my ego, all of that when getting on the ice, you know? And I was terrified, you know, but I did it. And then when I got off, I'm like, holy cow, I just did that. And it's amazing to me what this, my life keeps giving me now, and things I never would have imagined. You know, not even just the things I wanted back. I'm getting more, and my perfectionism is slowly improving or decreasing, and I'm learning to, you know, not be all or nothing. You know, I can be good at some things, but not others. I'm not meant to be God, right? So I'm getting better with that, but I'm a work in progress, and I always will be. There's always something I'm learning. And I'm so grateful for all of you guys and, you know, my people, finally. And it's just wonderful. But I want to close with I don't know if you guys have this book, Daily Reflections, but from December 31st, I read it, and I just thought it was really cool, and it kind of helps me keep things in perspective. It's called Daily Resolutions. The idea of 24-hour living applies primarily to the emotional life of the individual. Emotionally speaking, we must not live in yesterday nor in tomorrow. A new year, 12 months, 52 weeks, blah, blah, blah. A time to consider directions, goals, and actions. I must make some plans to live a normal life, but I also must live emotionally within a 24-hour time frame. For if I do, I don't have to make New Year's resolutions. I can make every day a New Year's day. I can decide today I will do this, today I will do that. Each day I can measure my life by trying to do a little better, by deciding to follow God's will, and by making an effort to put the principles of our AA program into action. So thank you for listening to me. Thanks.
And for that performance, she got a gold medal, by the way, which she did not say.